You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Marriages often founder because one of the spouses has fallen in love with someone else. But what if the rival is a horse? The answer to that peculiar question can be found in Margot Livesey's most recent novel, Mercury, which is published by Harper and brings her back to our show today. She is the New York Times best-selling author of a number of other novels, A Flight of Jim Hardy, The House of Fortune Street, On Fortune Street, Banishing Verona, Eva Moves of Furniture, The Missing World, Criminals, and Homework. And you've been here to talk about a number of those in the past. This is your eighth book, but your first novel that's primarily set in America.
It is, Leonard, and it's been a big thrill to move to this side of the Atlantic after spending most of the last 30 years living here. Suddenly I'm writing about Americans.
Do you feel finally comfortable enough to write about this country you've lived in for 30 years? You've been writing about Scotland in the past, and Scotland does find its way into this story.
It does. I couldn't quite leave Scotland behind, and so I have one of my two narrators, Donald, the husband, be Scottish, Scottish living in America. But I do, all the other characters, I'm happy to say, are American, and I hadn't realized how much fun that would be and how interesting that would be.
Well, often people will ask a male writer about getting into a woman's head, or a female writer about getting into a men's head. And, of course, that's what writers do. I would think that it wouldn't be all that difficult for a British writer to get into an American head, or vice versa. Is it a matter of syntax that separates Brits from the United from Americans?
Well, I think syntax is one thing, a certain kind of optimism, or if you like, American exceptionalism is another thing. And trying not to, satirize Americans. I didn't want everyone to be saying wow and gee and neat and Jiminy Cricket.
Well, American exceptionalism isn't all that different from the way the Brits were when they had the empire and thought that they were the most powerful nation on earth, even after World War II, when Britain was largely diminished.
That's true, but for Donald, my optometrist husband, he would say he's not British, he's Scottish, and we're used to being underdogs, and self-deprecation is the modus operandi.
And we just saw that recently when Scotland voted against Brexit when the rest of the country voted for Brexit.
Yes, and Scotland has always had, I think, a stronger, less ambiguous tie with Europe.
The name Donald has special significance in this story, but not one that pre-election readers might think. You make the point in your opening paragraph that it means something very different in Scotland.
I know. I began the novel at a time when the name Donald struck me as a wonderfully original choice, and I chose it in tribute to a Scottish king of the 11th century who reigned twice briefly and disastrously. So I've been a little distressed to find it taking front and center stage in American life for the last year.
The third main character in the story is a great thoroughbred horse named Mercury. Have you had much experience with horses?
Well, growing up in Scotland, I used to ride Highland ponies at the nearby farm. They were small and stout, and they would do two things. They would go forwards and they would stop. But I also read a very...
It's like riding a mule.
Exactly. I also read a very... also rode a very well-trained horse called Ginger, who gave me a glimpse of what it would be like to ride an animal that would actually do what you wanted.
What's Viv's relationship with Mercury?
Viv is someone who, like me, grew up riding horses, and then after a disappointing experience trying to compete, puts horses aside and goes into working in mutual funds. And then a good friend asks her to help running a riding stable, which she very happily does. But after a couple of years, she's in a kind of doldrums. She has two children she loves, a husband she loves, but she's just not satisfied. Everything tastes of ashes, she thinks. And then this amazing horse shows up at the stables, Mercury.
And their relationship seems like more than just companionship. It's almost like an affair. Is it similar to the kind of close bonding that some people will have with their dogs? Or are horses very different?
Gosh, I don't know if I'm qualified to speak on the difference between canine and equine relationships. I do think people have very intense relationships with animals that are quite hard to capture on the page without sentimentality or anthropomorphization.
Viv thought that she was meant for greatness. Does Mercury awaken that sense in her again?
Very much. When she sees Mercury, she thinks, oh, this is the chance to fulfill the dreams of my girlhood. This is a horse I can ride to greatness. He's a superb athlete, very well trained, only 5 years old. The world is open to them.
Her passion is horses. Donald's is eyes. He's a practicing optometrist. Did you give him that profession because he's kind of, even though he's really concerned about helping people see, he is kind of blind in some ways himself?
Well, Donald is myopic. I feel bad saying that about him. Perhaps I should say more appropriately that his vision is narrowed by grief, the grief of losing his father, just as Viv's is narrowed by the obsession of loving Mercury. I made Donald an optometrist because I've been wearing contact lenses since I was 18, and I've always been fascinated by all the things we bring to eyes, how we imagine they're the windows of the soul, and we attribute so much emotion to them and so much value to seeing.
But for over one-third of the book, he is blind to what's going on in front of him. You have told this story in first-person narratives. He starts off the book, and then Viv, and he finally gets the last word. But to some degree, were you aiming for a sort of a Rashomon thing, the same story from very different perspectives?
I think rather than a Rashomon effect, I was seeking to show in the part of the narrative that Viv tells how it was that a middle-class, middle-aged, comfortably off white woman comes to take the very extreme action that she does. She becomes so concerned about Mercury's safety and well-being that she takes the extreme step of driving to New Hampshire and buying a gun.
I don't want to give away too much of what happens.
No, we mustn't give away too much.
But she's somebody who wouldn't have had a gun under normal circumstances.
And she's someone who campaigned ardently for gun control under normal circumstances.
Margaret Fuller's name comes up more than once in the book. She's mentioned by both Viv and Donald. What does she represent to these characters?
Well, I think what she represents is the need for, in the 19th century, obviously, Fuller was a feminist before her time, and she also represents the voice of Emerson and Thoreau and the voice of American individuality. Viv grew up believing she could be president. Donald's response to that is rubbish. Only one person in 250 million can be president.
He's not saying it's because you're a woman. He's just simply saying the odds are against all of us.
Exactly.
In effect, you really are telling much of the same story twice. Does that present difficulties?
It did present certain difficulties, but I think what also made it easier was both that Viv is American and also her great passion for horses. Donald is almost oblivious to horses. They're nice four-legged animals his wife works with. So in writing from her point of view, I hope to capture what it's like to be in love with a horse and to be tremendously ambitious.
She seems trapped into her relationship with Mercury, but how does she deal with Donald's feelings and his state of mind throughout all of the book?
She begins by being sympathetic to his grief over losing his father. His father dies from Parkinson's, so it's not an unexpected death. But it hits Donald in surprising ways and surprisingly hard. And I think she's just unprepared for how it sort of wraps him in a cocoon and separates him emotionally from her and from their children.
Now, you have also taught at a number of schools. You've been at Yale. Now you're at the University of Iowa's Writers' Workshop. Would you suggest to a student that he or she write a book with this kind of structure?
I easily might, I think, because I think point of view is so crucial in both life and fiction. I mean,
you prefer writing in first person?
No, I would not say that. But I do think it's so interesting to get into the head of other people, and that's a big reason why I read and also a big reason why I write.
Mm-hmm. And why you still invent characters. Obviously, neither of these characters are yours, so we don't have to go into that autobiographical question that writers absolutely hate hearing.
I think I'm writing an autobiography that is being pieced out very cautiously in my various novels. And when I get to the end of my writing life, I'll be able to look back and say, oh, there's where I told this secret and there's where I told that secret.
And only people who really know you well would even know that it was one of your secrets?
I hope so.
I'm assuming that you're working on another book.
I have started trying to write something else, and it remains a little uncertain to me which side of the Atlantic I'm going to be on or whether I'm going to fly back and forth.
How far into a book do you realize where a book is going?
Usually I have a fairly clear idea at the beginning of my destination, but not the route by which I'm going to reach it. So there are often wrong turns and cul-de-sacs.
But I'm assuming in this case you knew from the start that you'd be writing two first-person narratives.
I knew that I wanted to write about a very ambitious woman whose ambition, I would say, crosses a line into obsession. And I knew that I wanted to bring together optometry and horses to create a world for these characters.
The book is called Mercury, and it's Margot Livesey's latest novel. It is published by Harper. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you so much, Leonard.